blame faculty or staff. Last year, if you recall, there was a voluntary separation agreements were entered into so that we could have early retirement for about 30 people. And at that point, we were looking at a $3 million deficit that was funded through a one-time dividend from one of the investments in our endowment. So we basically got by on that deficit at that time, and that was discussed with faculty and staff. In fact, there were many people who sought to take advantage of that voluntary separation.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project has been working to protect and restore the ecosystems of the Blue Mountains in Eastern Oregon Cascades since 1991. This annual benefit party features DJs, speakers, cider, and more. Again, that's the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years. Serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar on North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com. Now it's 5:01, time for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a school bus crash near Sandy has led to multiple minor injuries.
And in international news, the UN is warning that there may be a new crisis for our Rohingya refugees.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 12th, 2019. I'm Ian.
And I'm Leslie McLam. A school bus from Alice Ott Middle School was involved in a three-vehicle crash just before 10 a.m. this morning on Highway 26 near Orient Drive. According to Oregon State Police, the bus was traveling west on Highway 26 when it struck a passenger car in the intersection of Orient Drive. The bus then careened into the eastbound lane where it collided with a third vehicle. The driver of the bus became trapped and had to be extricated by the Clackamas Fire and Rescue. Both drivers of the other cars, along with seven students, were taken to an area hospital with minor injuries. The remaining students were loaded onto a separate bus and returned to the school. The highway was closed in both directions for several hours while the scene was cleared and the police investigated the cause of the accident. KBOO News spoke with Captain Timothy Fox of the Oregon State Police, who informed us that someone apparently ran a red light. However, it is unclear who. Captain Fox added that alcohol and speed do not appear to have been a factor.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler is sharply criticizing both the police bureau and local prosecutors for not doing more to arrest protesters from both left and right who oftentimes come to blows on the streets. Mayor Wheeler cited in a fight in October 13th of last year outside a downtown bar between the right-wing group Patriot Prayer and the leftist Antifa, where combatants used fist, clubs, and in one instance mace, yet police did not make a single arrest. Wheeler said officials in Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, Rod Underhill, told mayoral aides that prosecutors could do nothing because the law allows for, quote, mutual combat between people fighting. Wheeler says that this statement is unacceptable and called for change in the law that would make it possible to arrest street fighters. The police have also been under fire as of late, as it was revealed that the police lieutenant was sending text messages to the leader of Patriot Prayer concerning the movements of left-wing protest groups.
The Burgerville Workers Union may be expanding. Workers at both the Montevilla and Convention Center locations have announced plans to file for union elections with the National Labor Relations Board. If both stores unionize, it will bring the total number of Burgerville restaurants in the Portland area under the union banner up to 5, according to a statement by the union worker. Complaints in both locations include intolerable working conditions, as well as arbitrary and retaliatory firings. These complaints have been disputed by Burgerville management. The company said in a statement that they, quote, respect the right of every employee to support or not support the organization of a union. Last April, KBOO News reported on the chain's location at 92nd and Powell becoming the nation's very first fast food workers' union.
Starting April 1st, large retailers in Salem will no longer provide plastic carryout bags at checkout. Shoppers will need to bring their own reusable bag or purchase a paper bag for 5 cents. For stores that sell both retail items and prepared food, plastic carryout bags will still be given at checkout for prepared food items. However, by September 1st, no retailers in Salem will provide plastic carryout bags. Retailers may provide recyclable paper bags or reusable bags for customers to carry away purchases. To encourage the use of reusable bag and offset the high cost of paper bags, retailers must charge at least 5 cents per paper bag given at checkout. This charge is called a pass-through cost and will be reflected on the customer's itemized receipt. Retailers must also provide a free carryout option to low-income customers who request a bag and show an Oregon Trail card or assistance voucher.
A resolution up for vote by the Portland City Council on Wednesday will consider requesting more federal studies to be conducted on the potential health impacts of 5G technologies. The resolution states, quote, there is evidence to suggest that exposure to radio frequency emissions generated by wireless technologies could contribute to adverse health conditions such as cancer. Wireless companies in the U.S. say they'll have to install about 30,000 new antennas, close to the total number of cell towers built over the past 3 decades. This substantial increase in cell towers deployed in communities means greater contact with them.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with activist Kevin Ward, a filmmaker, and filmmaker Lindsay Grazel about their film The Reluctant Radical. Then, at 5:30, it's Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6, it's Preference. Then, at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow will also be cloudy, with a high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1930, Mahatma Gandhi begins his 241-mile civil disobedience march in protest of the British monopoly's assault on India. India's independence from Britain was finally granted in August of 1947. Gandhi was assassinated by a Hindu extremist less than 6 months later. The quote of the day is from Mahatma Gandhi, who said, quote, a man is but the product of his thoughts, what he thinks he becomes.
Salvador del Solar, actor and former culture minister, has been sworn in as Peru's new prime minister. President Martin Vizcarra made this change in an effort to shore up his declining approval ratings. Del Solar has degrees in both law and international relations, but is best known for acting in Spanish-language films and television series, including a role in the Netflix drama Narcos. It is not uncommon for Peruvian presidents to make changes in their cabinets when approval drops. Vizcarra replaced 8 members in all, keeping only Finance Minister Carlos Olivia, and Energy Mines Minister Francisco Ismodes. Vizcarra's rating dropped to 56% in March after he was criticized for state visits to Spain and Portugal during a time of flooding and landslides in the country that many people felt warranted his attention.
The United Nations is warning that Bangladesh might be creating a new crisis for the Rohingya refugees. The Bangladeshi government is planning on to relocate 23,000 refugees to an uninhabited island prone to cyclones. The UN special reporter for Myanmar warned that the Human Rights Council that she is unsure if the island of Basanchar is even habitable. Advocates for the Rohingya say they would be effectively be trapped on the island. Basanchar is a muddy and low-lying. It floods frequently during monsoon season and offers few livelihood opportunities. Currently, more than 730,000 Rohingya are stuck in overcrowded camps in Bangladesh after fleeing violence perpetrated by the Myanmar military. Despite the objections, the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the island, arguing that it would relieve the pressure on the camps.
TriMet is asking for rider feedback on their new Trip Planner mobile app. The new version of the Trip Planner allows people to plan trips with connections between transit, ride-sharing services, bike rentals, and walking. The previous app only allowed people to connect transit based on biking and walking, while the new planner adds routes using Uber, ShareNow, and BikeTown. TriMet says it will make it easier for people to get around the region. TriMet began working on the new Trip Planner in January of 2017, after being awarded an almost $700,000 Mobilities on Demand sandbox grant from the Federal Transit Administration. If you are interested in trying the new app and want to give your feedback, visit betaplanner.trimet.org.
Climate activists and community organizations in Portland are planning an event tomorrow to protest the expansion of new fossil fuel infrastructure. In 2018, Zenith Energy Management began exporting tar sands oil out of the northwest Portland from a facility previously used for asphalt. In spite of city and county opposition to oil trains and new fossil fuel infrastructure, Zenith is expanding their facility to even more tar sands oil can be processed. The expansion would increase the number of dangerous oil trains running on the rails through the Pacific Northwest communities. To protest this expansion, an event is being held by multiple community organizations including Stop Fracked Gas PDX, Columbia River Keeper, 350 PDX, and the Center for Sustainable Economy. The event will take place tomorrow, March 13th at 9 a.m. in the Portland City Hall courtyard. Attendees are encouraged to wear red in support. For more information, visit the Facebook page Zenith Didn't Get the Memo or call Dr. Melanie Plout at 503-544-8227.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 12, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanaglu, Emily Gresham-Beamer, Al Khan, and Ian Rankins. The producer is Yasmin Kobanaglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Ian Rankins. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodwin and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues and taking your calls. At 9, it's The Radio Activist with host Lisa Loving and Suzanne LeGrand. Talk to the director and producer of the documentary, The Reluctant Radical, as well as the star of the film, Ken Ward. At 10, it's Flashpoints, the award-winning frontline investigative news magazine with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on The Dirtbag, Glenn Anderson welcomes back world traveler Jim Gilbert, who will report on his recent trip to China searching for tasty and appropriate plants to grow here. All of this KABU programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kabu.fm and click on Donate.
For our in-depth segment today, we were supposed to run the second part of an interview with Karen Coulter about her work with the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. That interview will air on the news tomorrow. And instead, today we are joined by environmental activist Ken Ward and filmmaker Lindsay Grozel. They are here to speak about their film, The Reluctant Radical. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
So what was the inspiration for making this film?
The inspiration was meeting Ken and having a conversation about climate change that made me think differently about it than I had before. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I'm always interested in finding characters that can represent an issue and bring new information and new perspectives to that issue. And I realized pretty quickly after talking with Ken that he made me think about climate change differently, and that he was so willing to talk about the struggles of his work that he would be a great documentary character.
So what makes climate change different from any other issue?
Well, climate change is the largest crisis we face, the largest existential crisis we face. It's really just emblematic of the larger environmental problem of exceeding the limits of growth and also doing away with whole ecosystems that help support us. But it's the largest of those and the most immediate. And it's the only crisis we face that in the very short term threatens, in the words of Dr. Jim Hansen, threatens the conditions that make civilization possible.
When you say crisis, what kind of like crisis level are we talking about?
Well, the one I focus on, I mean, a whole bunch of them, but the one that is the most potentially civilization busting is that we're putting carbon in the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels, and that heats the air or the atmosphere. The atmosphere heats the oceans, and the oceans cause the large ice shelves in Greenland and Antarctica to melt. They're now melting, and scientists now use the island of Manhattan as the example of the size of chunks that are melting or dropping off, and that's not supposed to be happening. And chunks of the ice shelves are in what now described as unstoppable collapse. The only question is how fast will that happen? And as that's happening, it will dramatically raise the level of the oceans.
And so, to deal with this problem, you've taken upon yourself to do some different direct actions. Can you tell our listeners maybe a couple examples of what direct action is and what you specifically have done?
Sure, although I would note, like as if I was talking to a jury, I would note that I spent decades pursuing a whole set of legal alternatives before I even thought about doing anything like protest or direct action. So I spent years in legislatures and in courts and in federal treaty negotiations trying to address this and other problems through the available legal means. That didn't work. And starting about 6 years ago now, I started to involve myself in what's called climate direct action, which is finding examples of the particularly egregious forms of fossil fuel use, so coal and tar sands in particular, and then trying to, with friends and supporters, put our bodies in the way to actually stop the burning. So the first time I did it was with a friend, Jay O'Hara. We bought a lobster boat and plunked ourselves in front of a very large coal freighter off the coast of Massachusetts and blocked that ship with 40,000 tons of coal for about a day. And I took part in the Fennica action, which happened here in Portland. About 2 years ago, with some friends, we Went to what are called valve stations at the five pipelines that carried tar sands oil from Canada into the U.S. And on one morning, we turned off the valves, called the company first, and turned off the valves and shut down all the flow of tar sands oil from Canada into the U.S.
So when I was watching the film, I remember you calling the company before you guys did that. What was the reasoning behind actually warning them about the direct action you were going to take?
Well, we spent a lot of time trying to understand how pipelines work and what are all the factors in the engineering and the safety protocol because we wanted to do this, obviously, in the safest possible way. The safest possible way is to present the pipeline company with a credible threat of closing the valve, and so they will do it themselves electronically and from their control headquarters. And that's what happened in all five cases. Some of them acted more quickly than others, but that was our aim, and so we gave them considerable notice. We called them 15 minutes before we got to the valve sites, and we also in several cases we live streamed ourselves because we know that in past cases they didn't necessarily believe that someone was there. I mean, they might credibly wonder if it was just a hoax. So we wanted to provide them with incontrovertible evidence. So we were live streaming ourselves on Facebook so they could know we were actually there.
So what were the kind of thoughts running through your head as you're on the ground and you're in the middle of doing that? What were you thinking?
Well, let's see. Before I did it, I was thinking, what am I doing here? is this really a good idea? This doesn't seem like entirely a great idea. Once I started actually doing it, which for me would be when I cut the chain on the fence and went inside the grounds. After that, it was just, it was like anything else you do that you've thought about or practiced for a while. It was just kind of methodically going through the checklist in my head to make sure I was doing everything correctly and safely and so forth. So it was just sort of doing what I'd practiced.
And then you faced some legal repercussions because of that. Can you explain for our listeners what happened after?
We did. Including Lindsay here and another videographer. The three of us, the only people on the site, were all arrested, held in jail for a couple of days in Skagit County, and then initially charged with, I think it was four charges on the part of the videographers and five in my case, including some rarely used state laws of sabotage and other felonies. Some of those charges were dropped. Eventually, they were all dropped against the videographers. Mine were whittled down to two charges of burglary and sabotage. And then I went to trial twice. On the first time, in neither case was I allowed to offer what's called a necessity defense, where I could have explained to the jury why I was doing what I was doing, and at least make the argument that we were trying to address this bigger problem.
And other people involved in the incident were able to use that defense?
Two of the folks, or two of the five valetrenters, were granted permission to offer a necessity defense in theory, but then when we actually showed up at trial, the judge restricted testimonies to effectively rule it out. So no, not really. And at least in two of our cases, Leonard and Higgins, who is in Montana, and myself, both have appeals pending in the appeals courts in those states because we weren't allowed to offer the only defense that makes any sense. So.
And what was the, like we asked before, what was going through your head when it came to the point of you actually going to jail?
Well, I kind of faced that one a while ago. I mean, the first time I considered doing action, and it was probably a two-year period where I was, as a writer and a speaker, and I think a climate strategist, was arguing the importance of undertaking climate direct action and sort of providing a philosophical and political basis, making the arguments for why it was crucial and why it was lacking in the U.S., and kind of hoping other people would go do it. And after a couple of years of that, when no one was doing it, I just decided that I really needed to. It just wasn't ethical or fair for me to be calling other people to do it without being willing to do it myself. So for me, the trade-off was just that I had a young son and I was the primary caretaker, and in the worst case, I would be potentially absent from his life for a while and being incarcerated. And I really wrestled with that, and I talked about it with his mom and others, and just concluded that the situation was dire enough, the need for undertaking this kind of direct action is strong enough, that it outweighed, and that the own that to take the action was an appropriate parental, action. That was my purpose as point as a parent, is to do what I can to protect my son and his friends and so forth and other family members from the biggest problems as I see them. And so I see this as the biggest problem. Therefore, I feel like I'm obligated, even at that risk, it's worth it. So I decided that years ago. That doesn't mean that every time I do one of these things, I don't have to re-examine it. But luckily, he's graduating from high school in May. He's going to go off, so I don't have the same limitations now.
Nice. Well, for both of you, do you see a big change or difference in activism over the past decade or two and how it's done, types of activism?
Well, certainly on climate, yes. We've had a wholesale shift in the course of the last decade. 10 years ago, there was almost no, well, there was no direct action and very little protest happening. It's still a small fraction of the, and if you look at the total amount of work that goes into trying to address climate change from climate activists and from environmentalists, the amount of energy and time and that goes into direct action is woefully small, in my view. I think it should be half of what we're doing at this point. We are at the point where what we need to do is disrupt business as usual in every way that we can do so, and direct action is the single most effective way of doing that. So we are better off now because there is some, there's everything from Standing Rock, fights over the pipeline, to other examples of climate direct actions, but it's just woefully inadequate.
So to aid that inadequacy, what would you like to see done in the future for climate change activism?
I don't think that we're short of people willing to take risk, which is, your biggest first step. I do think that we are very short of the kinds of things that people need to feel well supported. So we don't have enough lawyers. We don't have enough organizations engaged in training. We don't have enough money. It doesn't cost a lot of money to engage in direct action, but it costs some. And I think that we are also do not have the kinds of sort of political backup and support from the nominal environmental leadership and climate leadership. I mean, we have a lot of people and a lot of organizations, a lot of resources that are still going into trying to lobby our way through this problem, and that's insufficient.
And what would you say to people that are unsure of if they should be part of the people doing the direct action, or if they're worried or scared about the repercussions that come from it? What advice would you give them?
Well, I think it's great for the larger the number of people who can ask themselves the question of whether they would even consider doing such a thing is great, and it's very important. But not everyone has to answer that question yes. We don't really need a lot of people to do this. We do need a lot of people who are willing to engage in disruptive activities, but they don't all have to be illegal. Simply asking, wherever you're situated, asking what institutions am I part of, and are any of them invested in fossil fuels? And if they are, they should be, start advocating for them to get out. That's a form of disruption. Forcing the question into the political process is another form of disruption. And then also doing everything that you can to provide support to people who are engaged in direct action. I think those are all crucial things that people could do that are, several steps short of actually, risking arrest. And we do need some set of people to do that. So if we have, thousands considering it and hundreds step up, that's what we need to see.
And is there anything else that you guys would like to add before we end today?
I think just to reiterate Ken's point, there's a lot of ways to enter into the fight, whether it's as a supporter of someone who's doing illegal activity or a lawyer or just someone who's advocating to divest. There's a million ways to get involved, and I think it's great for audiences to be inspired by Ken, but my fear is that some say, oh, well, I could never do that, therefore I'll just go back to my life as usual. And my hope is that after people watch the film, they instead look at their own lives and figure out how they can help.
Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Do we have time to mention the other screenings?
Yeah, The Reluctant Radical will be screened tomorrow at St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church, located at 120 Knott Street at 7 p.m., and admission is free. Both Ken Ward and Lindsay Grizzell will be present for a Q&A session after the screening, and the film is also available online on iTunes, Vimeo, Amazon, and Google Play. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay tuned for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker when we come back.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to the KBOO Evening News and to us, Totality of Circumstances.
It's us.
I'm Sam. It is Sunshine Week, as we said. And what does that mean, Jasmine?
Well, so Sunshine Week is a week in which journalists and public information advocacy groups celebrate government transparency.
Really? I didn't know anybody celebrated that.
I know, it sounds pretty exciting, and it is, and it happens generally. I don't know if it was meant to coincide with the sun sort of hitting us for the first time again after a long winter, but it generally takes place in mid-March, and it also coincides with National Public Information Day, which is the day that all of you out there should be thinking of something special and coordinating, composing your public information requests, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
All right. And so we're going to start today with a little clip of our illustrious mayor speaking yesterday, and we're gonna go from there into the stories of the week that kind of highlight this sunshine
topic.
That
the
are
sunshine.
Highlighted by
yeah.
sunshine.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to explain this to my 12-year-old daughter, that we allow adults to fight on the streets of our city? Is there anybody here who actually thinks that this is a good idea? I don't. And if there is something in state statute, if there is something in the law, if there is something in code that says people who come here and engage in violence have not broken any rules or broken any laws, then we need to change the rules and we need to change the laws.
So that was a perhaps uncharacteristically emotional Ted Wheeler thinking about how he would explain Portland street brawls to his daughter. He was actually talking about a video that came out of a street brawl in front of Kelly's Olympian, but the whole topic of street brawls in Portland kind of came to the forefront after some a public records request was submitted by the Willamette Week and the Portland Mercury.
And I suppose we should clarify that it was submitted late last year.
Uh-huh.
So that's another side of it, is it took, what, 4 months or something like that?
Well, I think Alex Zielinski of the Mercury said that she submitted hers 6 months early, and then was it Bethany Barnes of Willamette Week who...
Katie Shepherd.
Katie Shepherd, I'm so sorry. Bethany Barnes is the Oregonian. Katie Shepherd submitted hers 3 months later, and the combined sort of clout of those two alt-weeklies led to the city finally releasing the texts between Patriot Prayers' Joey Gibson and Jeffrey Nia of the Portland Police Bureau, and that caused a whole muck-up, and there's been an investigation proposed, and there's been public hearings and things like that. And in the wake of that reporting, videos came out that had more weight now because of that reporting. Videos came out showing various street brawls, and the mayor was responding to that.
Well, and that's one thing that's great about public records being released, is that they can cast new light on old stories, or not even old, but, you know, this is from the last 2 years, and a lot of it is very fresh in Portlanders' minds. I mean, seeing, you know, groups of people and people with, you know, fascist insignias on themselves, you know, beating the tar out of each other on the streets of Portland. And it, like the mayor, bless him, said, it just doesn't make any sense to people looking at this why there isn't anything being done to stop people from beating the tar out of each other on the street.
Well, and so what the mayor said during that press conference, which we heard a little bit about on the PM News, was that the district attorney's office wasn't prosecuting these cases and had advised the Portland Police Bureau that there was no value in arresting these people, because in cases where you could argue self-defense, the cases were really difficult to prosecute. But as we saw just today in a new release of an indictment, that's not always the case.
Yeah, so that's one of the stories that spun off from the release of the Nia Gibson text, and that was the dramatic turnaround at the DA's office on prosecuting some of the right-wing brawlers for assault. Specifically, there's the case of Donovan Flippo and Tusitala Toesi, known as Tiny, who have been involved in multiple incidents of fighting and assault in the Portland metro area over the last 2 years. And more reporting by Willamette Week's Katie Shepherd brought the DA's failure to follow through on those cases into the light. And as we heard earlier, we heard our mayor griping about it at the top of the show, you know, how am I supposed to tell my daughter that street fighting is basically legal here, etc. So Ted was reacting in part to the DA's use of the doctrine of mutual combat. And basically that means that they're not going to prosecute people who engage in consensual fisticuffs. And the DA's office is apparently the only entity in the city, possibly the metro area, maybe even the whole space-time continuum, that thinks it's not an indictable offense to brutally injure someone in public, even if the victim is, you know, down to clown. So once again, we know all of this thanks to the great nuts and bolts reporting of Katie Shepherd over at the Double W, Willamette Week. And so the recent about-face by the DA stems from a case last year. It began on June 8th, and that's when Flippo and Toesi assaulted a man named Tim Ledwith in broad daylight after first insulting him from a pickup truck. I was able to speak with Tim Ledwith last week about this and the recent developments in the case, and full disclosure, we are co-workers, so quite the journalistic coup there. A longer version of the interview will be played on this show next week while Jasmine's out of town, and we'll upload the full thing to our webpage very shortly. So here, Tim is talking about what led him to file a police report about the incident, and remember, this took place in June of last year.
Right after I wrote like a long diatribe on Facebook saying, explaining piece by piece why I don't deal with the police, which I won't do now. I won't say now. Just because so many people in my life were trying to get me to do that, and I was like, no, this is why I don't do that. And then literally 24 hours later, I was agreeing to do it because I had been contacted by some people with the Western State Center,
mm-hmm.
Who study extreme far-right extremism and groups like Proud Boys and stuff like that, and basically, they had been involved in a case up in Vancouver where the same individuals had assaulted a African-American teenager at the mall and actually even reposted the video because the kid's friends took video during it, and then they even reposted it with some other narrative, but it's just them Right after I wrote a long diatribe on Facebook saying, explaining piece by piece why I don't deal with the police, which I won't do now. I won't say now. Just because so many people in my life were trying to get me to do that, and I was like, no, this is why I don't do that. And then literally 24 hours later, I was agreeing to do it because I...
Okay, sorry, we had a little... mix up there, but basically what Tim was saying is that he decided to file a police report because he heard from a group called the Western States Conference or Western States Council, something like that, that there was a similar case up in Vancouver where Flippo and Toesi had beaten up a young man of color at a mall in Vancouver, and that the young man was charged with a crime for participating in that fight, and nothing was charged against Flippo and Toesi. And so he filed his police report, Tim Ledwith did, to add to the record, and part of the result of that was that the charges were dropped against the young man up in Vancouver. And so now, Clark County prosecutors may have seen the light there, but nothing was done about the assault on Ledwith himself by the Multnomah County DA until after Willamette Week reported on it last month. So again, that's 8 months after the original incident, something around that. So now things are moving pretty fast. Ledwith was subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury on February 27th and told me about the outcome of that hearing and how he reacted to it as a person who is generally opposed to the criminal justice system as it exists.
Did grand jury went forward with to indict, I believe, assault in the third degree for both individuals. And one of those individuals, Tiny, is in Samoa, apparently. I mean, Tiny says he's going to come back and deal with it, but it definitely looks like he fled. I'm not the only case, though. You know, the thing with Tiny is I would imagine he would be held because Donovan probably won't be, but he would be probably held because he didn't show up for court and for any of his stuff, so he has all that, and that's doesn't look good, I think, but who knows. So yeah, basically, if they go ahead, if they actually do show up and turn themselves in or get arrested on their warrants, they will, 90% of cases, I think, go end up in pleas.
Mm-hmm.
So my only real involvement as of now would be if it went to trial, which isn't very likely. And then also, I guess, I get to give a victim impact statement if they do go forth with a plea. And with that, I probably would use it to push for because I'm really opposed to prison. I don't think it... I am opposed to it for humanitarian reasons, and I am opposed to it for even just practical reasons. I don't think it really... I think it perpetuates more violence and problems, and I don't think it... it's not going to make this... The public's not going to be safer with Tiny in prison.
And so there's a little bit of an update on that as of today. This afternoon, the DA's office unsealed... It's a 3-count indictment against Toesi and Flippo, and all the counts are related to assault, so it doesn't look like Toesi is quite on the hook for failure to appear yet. That being said, Katie Shepard and others have reported that Toesi's Facebook page states that he is still in Samoa, but plans to return soon to face the music.
the first mention of sunshine and then bed it down.
My life, my life, my life, my life in the sunshine.
So each year, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, or EFF, which is a sort of digital privacy advocacy monitoring group, puts out the FOILEs. And if you're not familiar with the acronym FOIA, it's the Freedom of Information Act request. So if you're familiar with like the Darwin Awards, which are the awards given to people for dying in the most embarrassing ways each year, the FOILEs are in a similar satiric vein, and they are given to public government offices who either decline or really just impede public information requests every year. So some of the highlights from this year's FOILE Awards are from the California Highway Patrol, which declined a public records request from a reporter about a rally that was held with a traditional workers' party, a infamous neo-Nazi group, related to a demonstration that they had. And then they used the fact that the public information request, the public records request, had been submitted as a bargaining chip to get people from the traditional workers' party to cooperate with an investigation. And then once the members of the traditional workers' party cooperated, they declined the public records request.
Wow. Okay, great. So there's also the Cash for Crash Award, which is being awarded to the Michigan State Police. Go Michigan State Police. What they did was, so the Information's Matt Drange filed a records request with them and multiple other state police agencies to get crash data held by those agencies. And he was doing a story about autonomous vehicles and trying to compare data and stuff like that. So the Michigan State Police responded to Drange, told him they had 1.9 million lines of data, and that they were going to consider each of them its own individual record, subject to a 25-cent fee. And so I don't know if you can do the math on that, but that's $485,625.24, which comes to $485,645.24 when you add in the $20 that they charged him for the thumb drive that they kept all of that data on.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And our last note from the FOILEs for this year comes from the Inglewood Police Department in California. They've been given the Preemptive Shredding Award. And so we'll be talking a little bit later about some changes to Oregon's public records laws that impact our ability to access all sorts of information that should be freely available to the public. In California, legislators passed a law requiring police and sheriffs to disclose officer misconduct records, and which have traditionally, I have to say, been very hush-hush. Like, it's very difficult, especially in Oregon, but I think it's true across the country. It's very difficult to get access to officers' disciplinary files or anything relating to do with their discipline. So in response to this happening, which took effect on January 1st, the Inglewood Police Department began just shredding all of their officer misconduct files.
I remember reading about that when it happened, and to be honest, I can feel it each time one of those things is shredded.
The shredding?
Yeah.
Right.
And so on to body cams, I suppose. Speaking of public records and murky public records.
Right. Speaking of the potential occlusion of transparency, Mayor Wheeler had another interesting thing to say at yesterday's press conference, which was that, so, for those of you who religiously read the city council agenda on Friday, which I'm sure is nearly all of you, because who wouldn't, you may have noticed that there was an item on the Thursday PM agenda that was the allocation of $1.6 million to the Portland Police Bureau's body cam project. Well, Wheeler, in response to some confusion from the press and the public, did a little bit of backpedaling today and said that he's likely to take that item off of the agenda, and then sort of boiled down the reasons being because, you know, we still really need to get to the nuts and bolts of this one issue.
But the biggest question around body cams is how do you balance two competing goals, two competing priorities? Transparency on one hand and privacy on the other. Because with increased transparency, which body cams are designed to provide, comes increased concerns about privacy. And so the conversations we're engaged now is where are we going to draw that line between transparency and privacy? And that has to be codified in policy. And so we've got about a year to really do that hard work.
So Wheeler mentioned there that we have about a year to really do that hard work. Tammy Mayer of the Portland Police Bureau has been leading this sort of public input into the body cam project. And she was at the CRC last week, the Citizen Review Committee meeting, which normally hears appeals of the public and officer complaints about officer misconduct. Last week, they didn't have an appeal, and instead they had what for Sam and I was the fourth presentation of the body cam policy. And the issue of the public's access to the body cam footage came up.
When there's, for the public, but for a person that's involved in the situation, like, what is their access to the footage?
If they are being prosecuted for a crime, their defense attorney can get it. We give it to the DAs, and then they get that in disclosure, so they will get it, and they can watch it with their attorneys. We do not give copies straight to a suspect or a victim. They have to go through the public request laws. Or the public request process to get a copy of any report and a video's a digital copy of a report.
Does that involve community member, like a victim in some sort of critical incident, would never have the opportunity to see the original?
No, because they would have to go through the public records release, just like anyone else, that a victim that has their car stolen or whatever, they have to go through that process to get a copy of the report. And anything we release publicly, because if we release it to you and you put it on YouTube, we can't control it after we give it to you. So it has to be redacted by public, by per the Oregon law, prior to getting it out.
Could you have a community member come in to see it?
That's possible. That's possible if someone requests to just come in and view it and not gain a copy of it.
So it's interesting that Mayor Wheeler sort of phrased that as a question about transparency versus privacy, because it's really kind of a question about how tight of a stranglehold will the Portland Police Bureau ultimately have on this footage, which body cam footage, which is intended to be a tool of Mayor Wheeler's using the term transparency, but what that means to the public is officer accountability. And what we've seen from some other places is that given the opportunity, police departments will just not release body cam footage. There was just a ruling out of New York in the last couple of weeks where the police department had intended to say that body cam footage was essentially part of a personnel file, and the union got involved, and because it was part of the officer's personnel file, it couldn't be released to the public. And the New York Circuit Court basically said that that wasn't the case, saying, quote, you know, we find that given its nature and use, the body-worn camera footage at issue is not a personnel record covered by the confidentiality and disclosure requirements. So that's one case. So now, kind of for the first time, body-worn camera footage from the New York Police Department is available to the public. There was another case that came out in that has sort of new developments, which is, if any of you remember the E.J. Bradford Jr. case from Alabama, where The young man who was on leave from the military was in an active shooter situation in a mall, and he was essentially filling the role of a good Samaritan, trying to get people to safety and calm the situation if he could. He had a concealed carry permit, and when the police officers showed up, they shot him in the back several times. Interestingly, we still do not know the names of the police officer who shot him, and the police department has said that the officer didn't turn on his body cam until after the shooting. But we don't know if any of that's true because they haven't released any of the footage, and they haven't released the name of the officer, and they haven't released a lot of information. So the ACLU has gotten involved in that case, and they're trying to get a resolution for the family so that the family can at least see the footage, which, I mean, I would imagine would ultimately become the subject of a lawsuit. So here in Portland and in Oregon and the state in general, there are some laws related to public records that dictate or govern the way that body cam footage would possibly be used. But some of those laws are coming up for review, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen.
So in Salem right now, there are a handful of bills working their way through related to our topic for the day. Government transparency and all that. So just some brief history. Oregon has what it trumpets as one of the best public records laws in the country.
But which most reviewers consider to be middling to poor.
Well, because it's been basically, it's still dying the death of a thousand cuts from just endless exemptions that
have been added.
And that's one of the things that is often brought up as a reason for the exorbitant price of fulfilling records requests that certain agencies, the Portland Police Bureau, for example, like to respond to records requests with. For example, I remember we requested maybe like a quarter's worth of Forced data collection reports.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, FDCRs. And we were hit with, what was it, like...
Over $5,000.
$5,000. So needless to say, we do not have those reports. We are volunteer reporters with non-lucrative day jobs. But...
Hey, man, come on.
Oh, well, I didn't... it's not something to define yourself by. But... and another thing is it's agency dependent. There are hundreds, thousands of agencies in the state alone with their own records systems, their own people who respond to records requests, their own internal policies about records requests. We have a handful of record requests open right now. Some are with the city, some are with the police bureau, and we get prompt responses from the city, and I don't think we've heard anything, let alone a response email from the police bureau.
I mean, I think the last records request we submitted, we were told that it would take at least 6 weeks for initial processing.
All right.
With the police bureau.
So some of the bills making their way through the Oregon House right now. For example, there's State Rep Karen Power from Milwaukee sponsored a bill, HB 2431, and that requires every... 2353, my bad. And so that requires that if the state attorney general, a district attorney, or a court of any kind determines that there was an undue delay or outright failure to address a records request, they can require the public entity to pay a penalty to the requester. And there's also HB 2431, which requires every state agency to submit an annual report on how many records requests were received and how many have yet to be fulfilled over a year. Interestingly, I wonder if that report would be a public record then, or made public.
I mean, I'm sure it would.
Yeah, that would be comical if it wasn't. And then there's also a bill to make permanent the Public Records Advisory Council, which was created in 2017 and is supposed to dissolve after next year. And that bill is being pushed by the... Ginger McCall, who I've lost. What she is the like public records advocate for the state. Is that accurate?
Right. So this like sort of newly created position in an attempt to get a handle on everything. And the very first report that she put out said, you know, it was a bit scathing. It's a bit scathing.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit accurate, I think.
Right. Accurate, scathing, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other. But so there's public comment on all those bills tomorrow at the Oregon State Legislature. If you're into that sort of thing, tune in and, you know, take the opportunity to comment if you want to go down to Salem, or there's an online option as well.
And just a really quick community calendar before we wrap up. Tonight at 6, which is literally right now, is the Keaton Otis Vigil at 6th and Halsey in Northeast Portland in the Lloyd area. And there is also tomorrow the Training Advisory Council is meeting at 6:30 out on Airport Way. I don't have the address off the top of my head, but it's out there.
Look it up.
Yeah. All right. I'm Sam Bowman.
I'm Jasmine Moneymaker.
And this has been Totality of Circumstances. Catch you next week.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. Previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a one-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour, and the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO Development Director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.